This blows my mind. Last year, because Ford Motor Company couldn't get access to enough chips, even for simple things like windshield wipers, they couldn't put together the windshield wipers. Ford's workers in Michigan and Indiana only worked a full week 3 times in the entire year. They were furloughed. They were put out of work because they couldn't put it together because they didn't have the chips.
Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo last week during a speech at Georgetown University, fewer chips meant fewer cars, and that meant higher prices for all of us. Well, today, the Biden administration is dangling a pretty big carrot above manufacturers to try to boost production of semiconductor chips used for everything from cars to medical devices to smartphones, even military weapons. Tens of billions of dollars worth of federal subsidies. In return, these companies will have to make sure their employees have access to affordable childcare and limit stock buybacks, and even share some of their profits with the federal government. Anna Swanson joins me now. She covers trade and international economics for the New York Times. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the opening of the applications is today, and will there be a big rush to get this, $40 billion worth of federal subsidies, do you think?
Yeah, so I think companies have been eagerly awaiting the release of this application. It's kind of the official unveiling of this big new program to build up semiconductor research and manufacturing in the United States. The Commerce Department has $50 billion to hand out in the form of grants and loans, and it's a lot of money. It's one of the largest federal investments in a single industry in decades. But given the huge cost of building these advanced semiconductor facilities, it could actually go fast, and competition for the money has been pretty intense. So I expect companies to really start vying for some of these funds in the weeks and months to come.
Okay, so in exchange, as I just mentioned, they're going to have to agree to certain conditions. Can you go into detail about these conditions?
Yeah, so there definitely are some strings attached here. You know, some of the interesting conditions that you mentioned are the requirement to provide childcare for some of their workers. The Commerce Department has described this as a way actually to ensure that the companies have access to the labor that they need, saying that labor markets are currently tight. But there's been kind of a lot of scrutiny on, you know, whether the federal government is asking more of companies than it has before. And then there are a variety of financial requirements for companies that are accepting the money. The Commerce Department said it would give preference to those that refrain from stock buybacks. Also, there's a requirement for companies to potentially share any unexpected profits that they might incur with the U.S. government. And the Commerce Department really described this as an effort to make sure that companies are as accurate and honest as possible when they're giving financial projections for these projects, that they wouldn't, you know, for example, exaggerate their costs or their losses in an attempt to get more money, because when they make that money, they will then just have to share it with the federal government.
I see. But wouldn't that encourage them to pad their losses so they wouldn't have to share the profits?
I guess that will remain to be seen. You know, the Commerce Department has said that they're bringing on former investment bankers and industry executives who are really going to get into the books of these companies and figure out the financials for these products. But there are a lot of critics saying that, you know, these companies can be really opaque. And when you save a dollar one place in the United States, you can spend that dollar elsewhere, for example, on your operations abroad. So I think it's going to be a very tricky act to kind of, you know, ensure that the money is spent in the right place. But the ultimate goal is to build up these semiconductor facilities that can help supply more of the chips that the United States needs.
And let's talk more about the child care provision here, because is that also an attempt to lure women into this sphere? And women are, in general, underrepresented in manufacturing.
Yeah, absolutely. So the requirement is for companies seeking awards of $150 million or more, so some of the larger awards, to guarantee affordable child care for the construction workers and for the plant operators.
Tell us more about that part, the child care part.
Yeah, so they need to guarantee affordable, high-quality child care for plant construction workers and operators. So that could mean that they build a company child care center near the construction site, or they could pay a local child care provider to add some capacity, or they could subsidize their workers' care costs. And the Commerce Department has said that this will help draw more people, more women mainly, into the labor force at a time when businesses are already struggling to attract workers in a relatively tight labor market.
Is there enough childcare, though, to be able to supply these workers with affordable childcare?
Well, that's a good question, because it's also a tight labor market for childcare workers, right? So, you know, the administration, the government right now is preparing to spend a lot of money into what is, you know, a relatively kind of strong economy and a tight labor market. And these dollars will be competing with other businesses. These semiconductor construction sites and companies plan to hire thousands, you know, perhaps even tens of thousands of workers, and those workers are going to have to come from somewhere, which is, you know, namely other businesses. So I think there are some big questions about, you know, if this vision is realized, what that is going to do to the economy, to the labor market, and also to inflation.
So is this an attempt on the part of the Biden administration to get through some social policy parts of their agenda in kind of a, I don't know, backroom way, in a way that they couldn't address it directly by mandating that companies provide childcare in a straight up bill, and so they're attaching it to this bill that passed with bipartisan support?
Mm-hmm. I think some critics do see it that way. I think the administration would counter that this is kind of part of their, you know, more holistic mission of just ensuring that these companies have access to workers, and that, you know, companies in the United States generally operate in the way that they want them to, with, you know, high-paying union jobs or using clean energy. But certainly for, you know, some economists, some critics of the program, this is reaching beyond what the government should traditionally do in terms of economic policy.
And do we know yet what the reaction has been among these companies? Are they balking at this, or are they thinking, okay, sure, no problem?
The statements from the companies have been mostly positive. I think, you know, you have to note that it's a critical time for companies where they're just beginning to apply to the federal government mm-hmm. for this money. So they're probably understandably going to be a bit hesitant to, you know, criticize the hand that is currently preparing them their dinner, I think.
Yeah. But if they don't do this, will they lose their funding?
Yes, in some cases they would not qualify for funding. In other cases, they might not be given preference. So, for example, the department is giving preference to companies that agree to avoid stock buybacks for a period of 5 years. So it's not clear that companies will indeed, you know, promise to do that, but just that if they were to do that, they would get preference over a company that may not promise to do that.
Anna Swanson covers trade and international economics for the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, more than 100,000 people lost power in this last series of storms. Why isn't Southern California better prepared? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Here in L.A., we may have seen the sun today, but rain is expected tonight and into tomorrow. Blizzard warnings are still in effect in the Sierra Nevada and San Bernardino until tomorrow. Over the weekend, more than 100,000 people lost power. Some in our area are still without it. In the summertime, the state's power grids are regularly strained by heat and fires. But this latest round of storms also shows how the grids are vulnerable to winter storms, a problem that's likely to keep growing with climate change. Joining us now is Andrew Campbell, Executive Director of UC Berkeley's Energy Institute at the Haas Business School. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. Okay, so, you know, here in L.A., a lot of us lost power over the weekend, over the last several days. But is L.A. normally more vulnerable to weather events when it comes to power than other parts of the state?
Los Angeles is probably, you know, as vulnerable in some ways as any other part of the state. But I think what's unusual in this recent storm system is when weather comes through that isn't normal weather, especially when there's winds that are abnormal and there's, you know, rain that's abnormal, that can just cause problems that you don't experience most of the time. So, you know, part of LA's challenge is that the weather is usually so nice and the trees are used to that nice weather and maybe even the utility companies used to that nicer weather. So when unusual conditions come in, that can create some challenges on the power grid.
I guess when we think of power outages, we think of extreme weather events. We think of a big wildfire. We think of a huge blizzard or hurricane or ice storm in other parts of the country. But this was just a few days of heavy rain here in Los Angeles. I'm not talking about where it snowed, but in the basin. So why would that cause so many problems? It's not like it's crazy weather.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, among the challenges right now, this particular winter, is because there are several years of drought, that even though this may be kind of normal rain over a longer period of history, it's unusual for recent history. So that can, you know, create challenges for trees, the, you know, the ground, and you see images of sort of trees picking up from their roots, things like that. So even though it might not seem like unusual weather, it's because we've had unusually dry weather that kind of makes it a bit unusual. And I think, you know, certainly a big question right now that requires some real scrutiny in Los Angeles and really everywhere in California is, you know, whether unusual weather is going to become more common, having swings in weather, and, you know, what does that mean for the power grid?
Well, it seems that way, that a lot of experts are saying that this is it. This is what we should expect from here on out, even more extreme weather. And so when we look at the power grid, where does it fall short? Is part of the problem that the power lines are largely above ground?
Well, maybe if it'd be helpful, I could just explain, you know, a little bit of, you know, how the power gets to people's homes to sort of frame that. You know, we have California's power plants that are often located certainly tens of miles away, likely hundreds of miles away from where most people are, you know, most people's homes. You know, that power comes into big transmission lines that you see when you drive on the interstate, and then into substations, which are these kind of complex, kind of ugly set blocks full of equipment that you'll see here and there. And then it comes down into the neighborhood streets. In many cases in Los Angeles, elsewhere, these are above ground lines. In some cases, they're underground. You know, above ground does create some additional hazards from the standpoint of, you know, a tree can fall on the line and take it down. You know, but the alternative underground, that has challenges too. I mean, some of the extended outages I've read about in Los Angeles have actually been in underground areas. The challenge there is a tree can't hit it, but you can still have problems, especially if, you know, earth moves, you have flooding. And with the underground system, it's even harder for the utility to diagnose where the problem is. At least with the above ground, bigger chance you can see the obvious, you know, hazard, a tree, whatever, that hit the line and knocked it down.
When they're underground, is the problem that the water seeps into the lines and causes them to short?
Equipment that's put there is equipment that can deal with being flooded. I think the issue becomes more when the equipment does fail for whatever reason and someone needs to fix it. Well, now the underground, you know, vaults, they call them, where a lot of the equipment is, those are full of water. So it's very difficult for anyone to do the repair. It's also, you know, if the problem occurred between two of these vaults, just under the buried line somewhere, then, you know, identifying that spot is really hard. So it's, with underground, the issue is you're going to have less frequent outages, but when the outages occur, they may be longer because they're harder to fix.
Where did places that are used to a lot of rain, how do they deal with it? Where do they see problems, if they do see problems? I'm thinking, let's say Seattle, for example. That is a very rainy city. Do they have power outages the way we have experienced?
I think the issue ends up being it's less about the rain and more about the wind that often comes with the big storms. So the wind is what knocks down the trees. That's the real challenge. So what I think of is hurricane country. I mean, the Gulf Coast of Texas and Florida, and even onto the East Coast. I mean, those are places that do get these really terrible storms come through. And sometimes it's a real mess. I mean, there's Superstorm Sandy several years ago on the East Coast, where the time to restoration was really terrible. But then, you know, I was looking at some of the national kind of reliability statistics, and, you know, Florida Power and Light actually gets a lot of awards for reliability. They can't stop the hurricanes from coming through Florida, but because they're used to those sorts of extreme weather conditions, they've invested a lot of money into the technology to kind of be able to pinpoint, you know, repairs, and they just have sort of the preparedness side of it down. And that's something where I think, you know, California, if we're seeing more extreme weather, I imagine the utilities are sort of scrutinizing their preparedness and whether they're kind of where they need to be for the future.
Does the new Infrastructure Act help them with that? Does it give any federal funding to upgrade?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the Infrastructure Act is going to be helpful, especially for the sort of capital spending, which is part of it, you know, putting in, maybe in some cases, putting lines underground, in some cases, putting in stronger poles in place of, you know, wooden poles. That's a piece of it. I think a challenge there is even though there's money in the Infrastructure Act, there's the needs are so vast in the country's energy system and those projects are quite expensive. So that's going to be, you know, not necessarily a ton of progress through that channel. And I think a lot of the real work is actually more on the operational side, where each individual utility needs to focus on how they prepare for and respond to outages when they occur.
Well, it looks like we're going to be relying more and more on electricity, you know, with in the summer running air conditioning because it's getting hotter. We're also phasing out gas cars here in California. And so more people will have electric cars. There's just more reliance on the grid going forward. So how is California prepared to handle that?
That exact issue is what worries me most when I read about an outage, that from a policy standpoint, the state really wants to and needs to move toward electric transportation in place of gasoline. But that's going to depend on, you know, millions of individuals deciding that's the choice they're going to make next time they buy a car. So every time there's a news article that's sort of presenting that, hey, there are some outages, there's sustained outage, multi-day outages, you hear kind of anecdotes about people's experiences. That's not helpful when people are trying to, you know, think about that decision and thinking about the reliability of their future transportation. So I think that's another big change in addition to climate change right now, is just the expectations and the needs we have for reliability in the electrical system are higher. So even if the reliability is the same as it's always been, that's not good enough for the future we're going into, where people are going to be depending on electricity coming into their homes as the fuel for their vehicles.
Mm. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Andrew Campbell, Executive Director of UC Berkeley's Energy Institute at the Haas Business School. Coming up, we begin a series of conversations with the directors of the Oscar-nominated short documentaries. Today, the director of Haul Out, it's about walruses seeking refuge on land during their annual migration as the ice floes disappear.
There were so many bodies of animals surrounding our hut that the temperature inside the hut was rising.
That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. On a remote beach in the Siberian Arctic, there's a small wooden hut that is home to a scientist, a man named Maxim Chakilev. Usually he's there alone with only the waves and birds and wind gusts to break the silence. Every fall he goes there to document one of the largest walrus populations in the world. Recently, the walruses have hauled themselves out of the water and onto land. That's Chakalev there talking into a dictaphone as more than 100,000 walruses crowd onto shore. They are pressed together and they completely surround his hut. The animals used to live mostly on the ice off the coast, but rising temperatures have forced them on land, leading to a harrowing fight for survival. This all was captured in the short documentary Haul Out. It's a contender for Best Documentary Short Film at this year's Academy Awards. And joining me now is one of the directors, Evgenia Arbugayeva. She's a documentary photographer who covers the Arctic, and she made her film with her brother, Maxim Arbugayeva. Evgenia, welcome to Press Play.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how did you meet the scientist and discover his calling or his job there alone in Siberia documenting these walruses?
It actually took some time. I've been working in this region for about 2 years. I was working on covering a life of indigenous community that live on the coast of Chukchi Sea. And this community live off the land and the sea, and they're still hunting marine mammals, and as they did for millennia, it's part of their culture. And one day they showed me this beach, which was very unusual looking. It was very dark, and it smelled really badly, and it was full of skulls and bones, and there was this old hut standing right in the middle of it. And they told me that once a year there is this huge gathering of walruses, thousands and thousands of them, and there is a man living in this hut all alone, a scientist. And I thought it was such a fascinating story, and me and my brother, we came back the next year to meet the scientist and to make a film.
Mm. So this scientist, he is not indigenous, right?
He's not, but he's been living there in this region for more than 10 years. He continues his research there every year now.
So describe what he does there. What is this hut like? Because watching the movie, it seems like a very, very stark existence.
Yes, he comes there in the end of August, and he stays for 3.5 months in this hut all alone. And he tries to count the walruses, the amount of them, when he records when they come in, when they leave the place, the gender, also how many walruses die every year, which is sadly is, you know, every year the number is increasing. And so he does this invisible work of scientists in the underground collecting data, and from this data we understand the population of animals, their migration, and how they're impacted by climate change.
So he's there alone for these 3.5 months, and how far is he from other people or any other village or anything like that?
Well, actually, the village of Chukchi people is not too far. It's about 15 kilometers, but nobody goes to this place. And so it really feels quite isolated. And what was interesting for me to find out that back in the day before colonization of this land, these communities, they used to have the spiritual leaders called shamans. And the shamans would go, and when walruses will come out, the shamans would go and live among them to protect them from, you know, from people, so that people don't hunt them, don't scare them. And now Maxim is kind of continuing this tradition without knowing actually himself. So that was quite interesting. People call him the keeper.
Mm. And so every fall, these walruses literally haul themselves out of the sea. That's why it's called a haul out.
Yeah. So in an ideal world, walruses rest on floating ice. They would not come out on land, but because there is no ice in the ocean in summer, they have to all gather on land because they just simply need to rest during their migration. And so they arrive already quite weak. And also they have to go and feed, and their feeding grounds are about 200 kilometers from the beach. And So it is really challenging for them. And because the gathering is so massive, they are prone to stampedes and trampling, especially weaker animals and cubs.
So there's a scene in the movie that is shot from inside the hut where Maxim is, and he opens the door, and all of a sudden you see tens of thousands of these walruses. It's almost like a horror film. It's like there they are right at the door. Can you describe that? And was that scary for you when you first saw that?
Yes, and actually I'm so happy we were able to capture that moment, because this is exactly how my brother and I first saw walruses. We knew that walruses are about to come out, but we were waiting. And then it was about 5 a.m. or something, and my brother came out, and then he came back breathing really heavily, and he woke me up, and he was like, "Hey, you have to see this." And I opened the door just like our protagonist in the film. I opened the door, and there were the thousands of sea of walruses. And also the light was so surreal. It was blue, you know, this dusk or dawn blue color. And it just felt like we were on another planet. It just felt so unreal.
And are they dangerous? Were you scared?
They look, they may look, you know, threatening because they're big and they have this huge tusks, but actually they're really vulnerable because they're not in their natural environment. And so they're easily scared of everything. So we had to be very careful not to make too much noise, also create any smell that they're not familiar with. So we couldn't, for example, use the wood burner or use generator when they're nearby, because the smells can scare them. And then this wave of panic would spread all over Holaut. So we really tried to minimize ourselves and just really, you know, be careful not to scare them.
I wonder if they're used to Maxim, since he's been coming for 10 years.
I think he's so careful when he's there, and he respects animals so much, and he's kind of in sync with them, which is also, it was very interesting to watch. At some point, because, you know, he's alone and there's not much dialogue, he doesn't talk too much, it almost feels like this line between human and animal is becoming thinner and thinner. And you know, when he's in this hut alone and surrounded by all these animals, it's also, you know, a struggle. It's quite a claustrophobic kind of environment to be in.
Right. So how did you manage, the three of you, in that hut for several months?
We made a really good team. You know, when you're up against elements and you really need to survive, you become a team. And we had we became friends. And Maxim actually is coming to LA for the Oscar ceremony right from Chukotka. So that will be yes, completely different experience.
Different environment, yeah.
But it was really challenging, because just this inability to leave the hut. And, at some point it felt like, because the hut is very, very old, so it was kind of shaking, and it felt like there were like an army of orcs from Lord of the Rings outside banging into our walls. And it was literally impossible to sleep. Also, the smell was pretty bad. You imagine the thousands of animals. And there were so many bodies of animals surrounding our hut that the temperature inside the hut was rising because of the heat of their bodies.
They're like your furnace. These animals were your natural furnace. And so, as you say, though, this is a dangerous situation for them, because they stampede each other when they're looking for food, and they shouldn't be on land at all. What happens when they go back into the sea?
Well, this is just a stop on the way of their migration. So if they go to Alaska, where they spend winter in Beaufort Sea, and you know they're waiting for ice to appear. So their migration and their life is very cyclical, right? It mm-hmm. depends on the cycles of nature, and because now it's all so unpredictable, their migration pattern is changing, and that's why it's so important for scientists like Maxim to be on the ground and to witness all these changes and to record it, so we know, you know, how these animals are impacted.
There's a scene where he's walking along the beach and he's documenting all the deaths, the dead walruses, the carcasses, and there's one female with a little baby next to her, and initially he thinks the baby's dead, and then the baby kind of moves and gets up and is alive. And he steps away from the baby. He doesn't go near it. What was he thinking? Was he thinking that he would harm the baby, or that the baby would charge him, or what?
Yes, this baby walrus lost its mother, and basically there is nothing that can be done now. And you know, then the scene ends with this baby going into the water, and unfortunately, you know, its fate is not it's basically, you know, going to die. And and there were so many moments like this that we were filming, and very hard to film, and actually we in post-production we had to put so much stabilization onto the shots, because when I was filming, oftentimes my, you know, I was just crying, and my hands were shaking, and especially in this scene, because it's just so hard to watch. But unfortunately, there is just nothing we can do. And these are wild animals, and there's also so many of them that one human cannot do anything. And I mean, we're talking hundreds of these animals mm-hmm. every year. It's happening every year. So the scale, you know, it's this particular scene is a representation of what's happening to many of them, really.
Yeah. How many of them die there on that beach?
So in 2020, when we filmed, it was about 600. And every year, it's, you know, the number is close to this. And unfortunately, we can only expect it to you know, to become bigger, because obviously, you know, the situation is not changing. So we're looking at a decrease in population of these animals as they're trying to adapt to the new climate.
How does Maxim feel about this? And as you say, he's been coming here for 10 years. So, and you describe this kind of rapport he has in a way with the animals. He's obviously a scientist, so he needs to be a dispassionate observer. But how does he feel emotionally when he sees these animals and the plight that they're in?
I think he's just so connected to them, and he's really worried about them, and that's why he keeps returning. You know, this job is it requires so much dedication. It's an invisible job that you don't get recognition for, really, and certainly you do not get rich by doing this job. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like almost a mission, really. And like many scientists that work in the field and on the ground, oftentimes at the expense of personal life, there's so much sacrifice that goes into this work, and all this is just, you know, tells us how much he really cares.
Well, thank you so much for bringing our attention to this story, and thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you.
That's Evgenia Arbugaeva. She directed the Oscar-nominated short film Haul Out. You can watch it now on YouTube or at newyorker.com. Coming up on this show, the dark comedy Party Down, about a group of out-of-work actors working as caterers, is back with most of the original cast. We'll talk with one of the creators next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means it is time for TV on the Radio.
It was you who shot J.R.
Can I do my...
I get an idea for a show about nothing.
Exactly.
Are you in the mafia?
It's a stereotype, and it's
Welcome
offensive.
Welcome to the OC...
Well, we've been talking a lot about the reboot lately, old shows making comebacks years after they went off the air. One of those shows is Party Down. It's about a catering company staffed by aspiring actors, writers, and really lost souls. When it debuted on Starz back in 2009, it was a bit self-referential. It starred actors who hadn't quite made it, like Jane Lynch and Adam Scott.
Ron, seemed like a star or something?
No, not really.
Who's your agent?
State Farm.
Awesome. They get you some good auditions and stuff?
I don't really act anymore.
That's cool. So like, what are you doing now?
Bartending.
Dude, nice.
Yeah.
Where?
Here.
The series lasted just two seasons. The ratings were abysmal, but it had a cult following that only grew stronger after it was canceled, kind of like Arrested Development. And now, 13 years later, Party Down is back.
Now it's a Party Down reunion.
Yes. What everyone's dying for.
It must be so fun to be back slinging derbs with the old gang.
No, it sucks.
Joining me now is one of the creators and the showrunner of Party Down, John Enbaum. Welcome to Press Play, John.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so how did you get this back on the air 13 years later?
We had a stroke of good luck, actually. We have been kind of trying to do more of the show from the very beginning, ever since, you know, before we even got canceled. After years of kind of going back and forth, we read an interview in one of the trades where Starz had a new head of the network, and he had said some kind things about Party Down in this interview. And so, you know, one of our other producers, Rob Thomas, just called him up and basically volunteered our services. That actually worked.
And did it help that these stars actually then had become stars in the interim? Adam Scott, we got on Parks and Rec, and Jane Lynch, of course, on Glee.
It certainly did not hurt, I'm sure. But it's funny that we started off with kind of this scrappy underdog cast that very much kind of fit the tenor of the show. And now they're almost impossible for us to schedule to get into the revival of the show.
Oh, yeah, because they're so busy.
But we were able to kind of scramble everybody together at one point.
Well, everyone minus Lizzie Kaplan, right?
She had a couple things that basically took her out for the entire, well beyond our available window. So that sadly was that.
Mm. Well, were they all eager to get back together and revisit the old days?
Yeah. No, we all have everybody involved, you know, whether it's the cast or, you know, us producers and everybody, we've all been very enthusiastic and, you know, excited to do it. You know, we love to do it both because we really like the idea of the show, and it's also a really fun show to do. So we're always ready for more.
So you came up with the original idea, right?
It was actually the original log line for the idea was Rob Thomas's idea. Before we'd even come up with this idea, we had started watching The British Office and things like that, that were kind of bringing this very different kind of character driven, slightly more kind of documentary style, realistic, you know, maybe a little, I don't want to say downbeat, but definitely a little more non bright and sunny kind of comedies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we really loved that idea, and we felt like this was something that, you know, we wanted to try and, you know, figure out something that we could do ourselves. As often happens when you're kind of in that kind of middle in, half out part of, you know, your career or whatever, where, you know, you'd go somewhere and you'd run into somebody who was, you know, working, somebody that you knew from their other creative endeavors, but then you see them, they're catering, they're bartending, they're doing whatever. Out of that, I think, you know, Rob basically called us up and was like, okay, team of cater waiters, every episode is a different party. And that we all grabbed onto that immediately. The workplace part of it, you know, definitely spoke to the tone and the feeling that we were all kind of trying to grab a hold of. But it was also something that we all knew pretty intimately. So
this was you, basically, you guys, the half in, half out part of your career.
In various stances, you know, we'd all had our ups and downs at this moment. You know, we were working at that time, but the memory of our kind of precarious days you know, absolutely lingered.
Can you talk more about that? Because I think this is something that is everywhere in this town. People come here, they have hopes and dreams, and they realize, okay, I'm not going to become a star overnight. I need to pay the bills. And at what point does one realize that one will never be a star? Or is that always in the back of your mind that, well, maybe this next audition will be the one?
The cliche is that you never give up on your dreams and you just keep believing and you kind of work and work and work and that you will finally achieve them. That doesn't account for the fact that that, you know, doesn't work for everybody.
You know, you make it big in this cultural void, and it only proves that you suck on some level.
It's good that you're not bitter.
I haven't even hit my intellectual peak. Toni Morrison didn't publish till she was 40. Proust, 43. I accept the possibility that I probably won't be appreciated in my lifetime.
There is that point where you have to start asking that question of, like, you know, how long do I hold out that hope? How long do I cling to that dream? How long do I make the idea of this kind of future success a key part of my identity versus thinking about who I am and what I'm doing in a new way? And it spoke to a lot of, you know, the kind of things that we liked, that it was a bit bittersweet in the sense that it was driven by these hopeful, kind of occasionally zany type people. Ideas of what they could achieve were various degrees of delusional. But that it also spoke to something that we felt like was not just relevant to Hollywood, but also sort of just a big part of the American dream or whatever, where it is assumed that you can achieve whatever you want to achieve. The reality is often different. And at what point do you pick a lane?
Right. And do you have to pick a lane? I don't know. It seems like they have a foot in both lanes, most of the characters.
Once we were kind of getting excited about this idea, we got, you know, we circled around, you know, who are we going to build this cast around and who's going to be our kind of character that we're really kind of following most closely. So the idea that we settled on Henry, you know, Adam Scott's character, who was somebody who had that taste of success, but through bad luck peaked and then went nowhere.
What was the name again?
Pollard, Henry Pollard.
How do you know Mr. Bradway? Is it Hardier Boys or OC of the Return?
No, from Party Down.
Never heard of it. Is that on cable or something?
It's a catering company. That's me right there, I think.
That says Henny Pollard.
Or maybe Henry Pollard misspelled?
Or Henny Pollard's on the list and you're not.
And so he was somebody who was forced to be dealing with that very question of, what do I do with myself? Who am I? What am I doing? Mm-hmm. All this kind of stuff. And so we would have somebody who could just kind of articulate that question right at the center of the show. And that, you know, you could see all around him, all these different approaches to that question in the form of these other characters, some of whom were one step away from something happening and others who were 10,000 miles away from something happening.
Are the characters different now, especially for the ones who are in real life bona fide stars? You have, like I said, Jane Lynch, Adam Scott, also Megan Mullally. Do you see the characters as different now that a lot of time has passed? Are they facing different kinds of questions?
Some yes, some no. You know, a lot of it just sort of depends on the way their lives evolved. For instance, Jane Lynch's character, at the end of season two, we ended up with Jane Lynch marrying this wealthy older man who then perishes in the limo as they drive away. And so, you know, she starts the new season, you know, with her inherited millions and all this sort of stuff. So she's basically been allowed to kind of maintain all her delusions because she doesn't have any material reason to kind of change in any way.
And I'm an actress / playwright. I'm also a widow / heiress, patron and donor of the arts, helping make dreams come true.
So we see Megan Mullally's character, who, you know, was always trying to sort of enable the dreams of her daughter, who wanted to be a child actor. And now 12 years later, you know, we basically see that she has kind of achieved some success there, and she herself achieved success as her manager, but she finds that it is not actually what she hoped it would be. So other people are kind of right where we left them, and everyone's a little different, just in the sense that everyone is,
they've been around the block. Yeah.
They've been around the block. The world has changed around them.
Yeah. And you added a couple of characters to make it more diverse. And one of the characters, Zoe Chow, is very funny.
Part of the original pitch of the show was at the time when we couldn't afford making real actor deals or anything, and we were at the risk of just losing people if they got a better offer. We had basically tried to make a virtue of the fact that it's catering, and so you're always going to have new people coming and going. We liked that idea because we liked the idea that we might be able to see new versions of and new perspectives on, you know, all these kind of themes and questions we liked writing about the show. Now that we got to do this, we got to bring in these two new characters who are basically giving us kind of what the dream looks like 12 years later. And, you know, with Zoe especially, I think we wanted to try to find a non-actor musician version of some, you know, a Party Down style aspirational character, but who brought in an entire new kind of craziness, basically.
Yeah, she's a little on the insane side of the spectrum.
Basic sheet cake done in an on-sale store-bought style with a center of ripened camembert.
What?
You get an innocent childlike sweetness up front, followed by an earthy whiff of decay.
Why?
It's a rumination on mortality.
Rumination on mortality? It's cake.
Birthday cake.
That's kind of her approach to like the level of cuisine. You know, she's somebody who is very, in the very Party Down way, has these very strong feelings about her art and her craft that nobody else understands.
So in general, do we like these characters? Do we feel sorry for them? Are they insufferable?
I mean, hopefully all of the above, because, you know, one of the things we talked about when we were first kind of delving into this was the fact that especially in this setting where everyone working this job and everyone on this show in the workplace scenario or whatever, they all want to be somewhere else. They all want to be doing other things. And this is just kind of a placeholder at best, and at worst, it's kind of a constant reminder of the fact that they aren't where they want to be. We always imagined that there was kind of a tolerance that, you know, they all had for each other because they all understood what they were all doing. But at the same time, we didn't want to start out with just this notion that this was like a lovable group of pals who all had nothing but the warmest feelings for each other. We wanted to play this idea that they all had, everyone in the group basically thinks they're the genius and everyone else is wasting their time in a certain way. We have this with Martin Starr's character and Ryan.
Everybody knows superhero movies are so much more than that now, right? I mean, they're like our version of Greek myths. Epic dramas with deep stuff to say about real life.
Deep stuff like the root of all evil is quirky supervillains.
Oh, no. Sarcastic voice. Oh, you got me.
Name one real life supervillain.
I mean, deep like in Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility.
An important message for your audience of unemployed virgins.
Wow. They drive each other crazy because they literally occupy kind of opposite ends of what each one thinks is important. And so like the intellectual versus basically just the handsome man or whatever is sort of a conflict as old as time. So, you know,
that's a good one.
It definitely, you know, I think it warped for us, not warped, but it definitely transformed over time just because we enjoyed making the show so much. The cast is lovely. They're like very talented. They're also really lovely people just hang out with. You know, we have a very goofy, enjoyable, great time making the show. I'm sure despite our hope that we kind of hold the line on being kind of clear-eyed and unsentimental, that we are in fact way more sentimental than we like to let on.
That's because you really identify with them. They could be you. They could have been you.
I mean, they were. So all of us did some version of all this stuff, you know, at some point in our lives. I certainly had my moments when I was a temp doing all these weird, random rent paying jobs, some of which were very kind of bleak. So we all get it. And we all kind of have affection for the struggles that these guys are going through. We've also had the experience of having this kind of, you know, workplace family that you're just like, ugh, I wish I wasn't here. So we wanted to try and at least keep a foot in both those kind of feelings, you know, where, you know, there's both the almost unstoppable affection that you can have for just the people who are around you, and contrast with that with this longing to sort of be somewhere else where you can be who you always wanted to be.
Party Down. It airs on Stars Friday nights at 9 o'clock. You can watch it on the Stars app as well. John Enbaum is the creator and showrunner. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right. That's the end of this party. Sorry to say. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.